So, homosexuality as a serious apologetic issue. I was born 1960, and during my short lifetime, if I can say so, the view in my culture on homosexuality has changed dramatically. So just during my lifetime, I've seen at least four different perspectives. When I was growing up, the general attitude in the culture was to see homosexuality as a disorder. And the general attitude was not to affirm homosexuality. It gradually changed into people started to think that, well, maybe homosexuality is not the natural thing or the best thing, but for a certain group of people, there is no other choice. They have not chosen this, and it cannot change. So it is a kind of emergency solution for some people. It shouldn't be generally affirmed or experimented with, but you have to accept that a certain group will live according to that lifestyle. Thirdly, the whole culture moved into saying, well, you cannot have that kind of down-looking on homosexuality. It needs to be viewed as a variation, an equivalent variation, one of the many signs of diversity and plurality. So it's more of a fascinating variation within reality. And it needs to be affirmed. And we should rejoice over this diversity. And for some people, it then moved into claiming this is actually a superior lifestyle. Gays have more fun. It's a more authentic life because you have not just followed the flow, going with the majority, but you have actually personally made a very conscious choice in terms of how you want to express yourself. So that's a huge change in a few decades for a culture. And of course, still there are variations. It depends on which generation you belong to. But in Sweden, I would say that the majority of people would affirm position 3. It's an equivalent variation. Now, when we're going to address this, let me remind you with what Peter says in the famous place when he talks about apologetics, always be ready to give an answer, where he is really strongly underlines, but do it with gentleness and respect. I think every time when we're talking about sexuality, we should remind ourselves about gentleness and respect. These are complicated issues. They are deeply personal issues. It can often be very painful and hurtful issues. And we should show respect, both towards the issues themselves and even more so to individual people, to persons who may struggle in a way that we have not a clue about. So let us remind of that to show gentleness and respect when we dialogue about this. There are many obstacles in trying to come into a dialogue on this issue. One is, of course, that it's often such a big difference between what is said and what is heard. So when I, as a Christian, try to explain this is a Christian position, and I try to do it with gentleness and respect, and still, what is heard is not actually what I'm trying to say, but it is often interpreted in a different way. So what I may be thinking of as an ethical statement, for example, that I think that homosexual relations are wrong, so I phrase it as an ethical statement, that is heard or interpreted as an anthropological statement. Namely, that I'm communicating, I don't accept you. And I think we need to be aware of this. not only thinking about what am I actually saying, but also try to analyze what is heard from other people when I'm saying those things. We are surrounded with a culture with a lot of clichés going around, and we often have to put some time into deconstructing those clichés to come down to what is actually the real issue. Where is the real tension between contemporary culture and the Christian faith? So, to take some example from my culture in Sweden, people would say, well, this whole issue is an issue of human dignity and human rights. And of course, all of us wants to affirm human dignity and human rights. And that applies to everyone who is created in the image of God. But here is a confusion. This is a cliche if you use this as an argument for a certain sexual lifestyle. Equal value and equal dignity, which we all share, does not mean that all actions are equally right. We need to distinguish between anthropological statements and ethical statements. Or people would say, it's our sexuality, whatever it is, it's genetically caused and unchangeable. And that will be an argument for the right to express a certain sexuality. Now, biologically, this is false, and it has been shown quite clearly that our sexual orientation is not genetically caused and unchangeable. But even if it was, genetics does not decide ethics. We need to discuss those two issues separately. Genetics does not decide in ethics. Ethics is a separate category. What is actually right and what is wrong? It's found in nature and therefore natural. Yeah, we can see things we would we think of like a homosexual behavior in nature, but nature and animals are not our moral model. It's a very dangerous route to go. It's actually a non-argument. What's happening in the animal kingdom cannot be directly transferable to the human relationships. Love can never be wrong. How can you be critical towards love? No, I'm not. I'm all for love. Love is always right. Love meaning to have compassion, to care for, to be committed to support, to help a person. Of course, love is never wrong. But not all love should be sexual expressed. Sexual acts can be right or they can be wrong. I recently met some Christians who wanted to live out their homosexual orientation, and for them the decisive arguments were, I've prayed about it and I feel peace before God. So they were Christians, and they that was their argument. Now, that's very important, of course, when we think about different issues, that we pray and we search peace from God. But in big ethical or theological issues, that is not enough. God also guides us through reason, through conscience, and if you're a Christian, through his word. And we need to have all those things come into play. So it's not a sufficient response. So we need to do a lot of deconstruction. I could mention a number of more clichés that we need to try to think through and say, these are not the real issue. We are not still discussing the real tension between our culture and the Christian faith. Let me just notice that the term homosexuality is not within the Christian scriptures. It does not belong traditionally to a Christian vocabulary. It was coined 1869 by a Hungarian journalist. He was the first one using homosexuality as an identity. And it came into the academic world a few years later. Now, this is very important to see that the whole thinking of homosexuality as an identity, it comes from science, not from the Christian faith. If you want to ask the Christian faith about identity, it does not describe us as straight or gay. That's not the labels we are working with. All of us, this is the biblical perspective, the Christian perspective on identity. Our identity, well, all of us are created in the image of God. We are created male and female. We are valuable, important, loved by God because we are unique beings. We are created in His image. That is our ontological and anthropological status. We as high beings, created in the image of God, have fallen into sin, all of us. And are broken people, separated from our Creator. And that is our biggest problem, our relationship to God. But since that is broken, all our other relationships are also broken. And now through the gospel, through Jesus Christ, we are called back to God to have a restored relationship to Him and gradually be renovated as human beings. Looking forward to the great day of resurrection when everything will be healed again. Our individual desires and abilities or disabilities or dysfunctions does not define us as human beings according to the Christian faith. They are not the defining elements of our existence. We are not denying that those things are there and are real and are painful, but they are not ultimately defining who we are. When the scripture talks, it never talks about heterosexual or homosexual identities, but it only talks about different acts. What kind of acts are in accordance with God's will and what acts are outside the will of our Creator. That's the perspective. Those of us who perform those acts, we are created in the image of God, fallen into sin, called back to God through Jesus Christ. As a Christian, when I think about those issues, I constantly remind myself that I have this high status of being created in the image of God, but I have also this broken status of being a sinner. And being a sinner means I see myself at the bottom. And from the bottom, you cannot look down at other people. I think that's very important. As a Christian, I'm not looking down on anyone because I've confessed. That's what it means to be a Christian. I'm not complete myself. I'm a fallen human being. I'm at the bottom. How on earth can I look down at someone else? So I want to dismiss that attitude, which usually creeps into us, but shouldn't be there as for us as Christians. So if we then try to evaluate what to think about homosexuality and about homosexual relationships, how can we do that? If we start not by introducing God or the Christian scriptures, but just start with a common starting point that we are human beings living together in this world, can there be anything like a natural law? Is it possible to think in terms of design for something? I actually think it is. Regardless if you think of this reality just in terms of nature or just in terms of an evolutionary process, you can still think in terms of what is something there for? What is the design or the goal of something? So if you take an acorn, it has the possibility of become an oak. It's designed by God or by some random processes, but still it has this possibility. And you can say, well, this would be the right thing for the acorn to be planted in an environment where it can develop into a full oak. And then you can think of a lot of situations where the full potential of what is there cannot be realized. So I think it's a valid question to say, are there indications for what you and I are designed for as human beings? And when we think of sexuality and homosexuality, are there anything we can notice in terms of indicators? Yeah, I think there are at least three very basic indicators. It's not very common any longer to formulate them, but I still think they are valid. There are physically indications. If we look at ourselves, our bodies, our sexual organs, it is a man's and a woman's body that belong together sexually. There's indications of that this is what our bodies are designed for, or what's the intention for our sexual organs. Biologically, it's of course undeniable that sexuality and reproduction is connected. We are sexual beings, if you think just biologically, in order to reproduce and secure that our species is not dying out. And of course, homosexual relationships are, by principle, biological sterile. Notice I've said biologically, in many other areas they are not, but biologically, of course, they are sterile. And if you want procreation, you have then to borrow from the heterosexual world, which is, of course, happening all the time now with insemination. And thirdly, it's not as clear as the other, but psychologically, a homosexual relation lacks the complementarity between male and female. Now, I think these are indications in a certain direction. What's the intention for us as human beings? When I say that, let me underline an important thing. There is a difference, a huge difference between moral and legal issues. All laws should be moral. All morals shouldn't be put into laws. I will give you a moral perspective on same-sex relations, but not a legal one. I'm a strong proponent for a free and open society where people are free to live the way they choose themselves. Of course, there are some limits to that. But broadly speaking, I'm for a free and open society. So this is a moral discussion, not a legal discussion. So people are free to choose their way of life themselves. But then we need to have this discussion. What is a good and what is a less good way of life? This needs to be distinguished from the discussion we have on same-sex marriage. That is a legal discussion. All societies have legal definitions of marriages, and you have to. And there's no way around it. You have to have one or another definition of marriage. That is a legal issue, and I've been quite involved in the discussion in Sweden of the legal aspects of same-sex marriage. But let us distinguish between the two of them. What I'm discussing now is the moral issue of homosexuality. If we move on to the biblical texts, and we do not have time to go into those properly, but I would say there are five groups of biblical texts that add to the picture from natural law for us as Christians. The most important text is the creation text, God's meaning with creating us as male and females, Genesis 1 and Genesis 2, where he creates us in his image as male and female and calls us to procreate and to unity. Secondly, The New Testament text in Romans 1 is the most important New Testament text where Paul very clearly says no to same-sex relations. And then you have two other passages, much shorter, the sin catalogues in the New Testament in 1 Corinthians 6 and 1 Timothy 1. In addition to that, and for me it's very important to say in addition to that, you have the Mosaic Covenant, two texts which talks about same-sex relationships, and you have two different stories in the Old Testament. Now, I think many Christians make the mistake of presenting the biblical case in a chronological order and starting with the negative text in Leviticus. Now, that shouldn't be our starting point. We should start in creation, and then we should go to the New Testament, because we do not apply in a direct way Leviticus. It comes in a more supportive way. After we have seen the creation story and we have seen the New Testament story, we can see that also in the covenant with Israel, we have the same perspective. And in terms of the stories, we never build our theology upon stories. That's always dangerous. But in this case, it also comes in and confirms our confirms the picture. The key text here is Genesis, which very clearly talks about God creating us as male and female and calling us to procreation. If we go to the New Testament texts, they are rather straightforward, and readers all through history have seen them as rather straightforward. The problem is that since a number of decades, there has come a new interpretation of Paul into play, where they say, well, Paul is not rejecting same-sex relationships on a principle level, but only if they are connected with idolatry, promiscuity, or with abuse, like pedophilia. And they often add that Paul didn't know about loving, committed same-sex relationships. So it's been a strong tendency to put aside the New Testament teaching and simultaneously, I would say, ignore the creation story in order to open for a new Christian understanding. But in my view, this does not work. If I take this last point here, Paul didn't know, that seems to be historically wrong. In antiquity, people knew about committed same-sex relationships, as is shown in Plato's dialogue Symposium, where they are discussing different sorts of homosexual relationships, and one of them are a long-term committed relationship between two adult men. So it's not a new or just only a contemporary phenomenon. Secondly, it's impossible to limit Paul's negative view on homosexual relationship only to certain context like idolatry or promiscuity or abuse. We have not time to read and study the text in Romans. I would just give you an overview which I think helps us to understand that text. Five observations for the text in Romans. There is an overall logic in Romans 1 where Paul is going through how we as human beings have dethroned God and put creation over above the Creator. We have made reality inside out, upside down. That's the overall logic, the tragic of the human condition. Then in verse 24 to 27, he talks specifically about same-sex relationship, both between men and between women. And there he highlights the homosexual relationships, not because it's worse than other sins, but because of its pedagogical function. It illustrates his overall argument of turning things upside down. Therefore, it's first in a list of then 21 other sins. It's important to notice that there is mutuality when Paul describes the men and the women who are having sex together, it's not an abuse situation. It's a mutual situation. They were inflamed with lust for another. So it's not abused. There's strong reference to the creation story. It starts with that all the way since creation. And Paul refers to the animal, quotes from Genesis 1. And of course, we can think of the identity of the author. This is a Jew who is writing this. And we know very well the Jewish view on homosexuality in antiquity. There was a universal Jewish view. Josephus, Philo, and others, they rejected same-sex relations with the creation story as an argument. So I don't see how the new interpretation can stand up for a critical analysis. So, as I understand the New Testament, both for Jesus, and we could have gone through Jesus' view on sexuality if we had more time, and for Paul, basically, if you ask what is the Christian point here, there are two categories. God calls us to marriage, which is one man and one woman, in a lifelong committed relationship. Or you are called to a single life, where you are sexual, abstinent, and you are called to use the special opportunities to live for the Lord that gives you. And let me end with a quote from Jesus, which is not directed to any specific group or any specific sexuality, but it's directed to anyone who is called to be a disciple, who's pondering over the cost of being a disciple of Jesus. Anyone who loves their father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. Anyone who loves their son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. Whoever does not take up the cross and follow me is not worthy of me. Whoever finds their life will lose it, and whoever loses their life for my sake will find it. And this is, of course, the sharp challenge Jesus have, whatever we have as high priorities in our lives, that he calls us to put him above anything else in terms of relationships or in terms of things or in terms of sexuality, in terms of whatever. To confess him as Lord is to say, I want to follow you in all areas of my life. Okay, that was quite slightly more minutes than I had hoped for, but that's life when given such a... Thank you.